Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, our series Overwhelmed concludes with a look at potential solutions for some of the challenges faced by patients at the Arizona State Hospital and a family that was separated under the Trump administration's mass deportation plan. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The reason this bill is being brought is that people are abusing the fact that we have this immunity. This immunity is not so that we can be speeding when we're not doing our jobs.
I can support taking action that would make election results more happen faster, but we're not gonna do that in a way that disenfranchises voters, and that's exactly what this bill does.
It really negatively impacts voter satisfaction when ballots are being counted for 3 weeks.
We want people to be safe. We want to make sure if somebody is here illegally, you've committed a state crime, you're going to be picked up from prison or jail and not released into the community.
If they're out there disabling these drones and they're falling out of the sky, my question is, why are you out there at midnight on the border? There's nothing good happening on the border at midnight.
Everyone has to stick with the budget they have until we understand clearer what's happening at the federal level, because it's impacting 20 county departments, 93% of our grants. I mean, we're talking how many millions of dollars.
And with me to talk about the governor's first veto of the year, a proposal to introduce bounties in Arizona and more, are Matthew Benson of Veritas. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Reginald Boulding. Reginald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So let's start with something that was not a surprise in any way. The governor had said basically she was going to veto this bill that would have aimed to speed up elections in large part by cutting off the time by which you can drop off your early ballot at a polling place to the Friday before Election Day. She had telegraphed she was going to do this. Not much of a surprise, but lawmakers this week also went ahead and approved, at least the House, approved a proposal to basically do the same thing, but send it to voters in 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's absolutely, you know, commendable that, you know, we want to speed up election results. And I think everyone wants to, you know, have that instant gratification of who won an election immediately right after. But the question is, you know, do you want to trade accuracy and safe and secure elections for speed? And I don't think that's what voters want. I mean, you know, we're in this day of instant gratification. I mean, if you're elected to office, you're not even starting until, you know, first or second week of January. The question is, can we wait 48 hours, 72 hours to make sure that we have an accurate count of who won an election? And I think we can. And, you know, if there were several solutions that Governor Hobbs and legislative Democrats tried to come up with, but Republicans just didn't want to take those compromises.
Matt, I would assume, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, I would assume that this proposal gets through the legislature to get on the ballot in 2026. I guess the question is, do you think, assuming that happens, will voters support this?
Well, let me say this. Yes, this measure is going to get to the ballot, so voters will have that choice in 2026. But getting back to something Reggie said, I mean, I think it's a false choice to say we have to choose either accuracy or speed in our elections. Okay, and I don't think. Voters expect instant gratification when they ask that they know who has won a race within a reasonable period of time following the election, because currently it takes 2 to 3 weeks, okay? And that's a long time. And that space in time that's a vacuum that allows all kinds of doubt and speculation and grifters and other people to crawl into that space and cast doubt on our elections. And that's a real problem.
How much of this do you think comes down to the fact that in many cases in Arizona and, you know, throughout the state, races are closer now than they have been over the last couple decades? I mean, this policy has been the law for a very long time now. You know, 20 years ago, you could still drop your ballot off at a polling place on election day, and it would still take a little bit of while to count. It just didn't seem to maybe matter as much because the races had basically been decided. The margins weren't so close.
That's true. I mean, California has even slower election counting than we do, but it doesn't matter there because their races are generally known and the results are called well early. But with Arizona and the fact that we are now a swing state and we have many very close races, it's just unacceptable that it takes this amount of time to actually get races to get the vote count completed. And getting back to what you asked originally, yes, I do believe voters are going to approve this because they do want to know, they want the vote to be counted and completed in a reasonable time following the election.
Do you think this, assuming this makes the ballot, do you think it passes?
Maybe it may pass. And, you know, I think, you know, if you have administrators in place, both Republicans and Democrats throughout, you know, the counties, you've had, you know, Republican Secretary of State and Democratic Secretaries of State. You know, if there was an easy fix and an easy solution, it would have been done by now. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, you know, we're going to have very close elections and we're going to, you know, have this, again, instant gratification of who won the results immediately after. I think it's unreasonable. I mean, and we're also talking about, you know, less than 1% of all of the races that are actually happening that, you know, that those nights. And I mean, if this is all really goes back to, you know, the 2020 Donald Trump election, you know, and when he was not, you know, selected by Arizona voters. And that seed and that doubt is just continuing.
But I wish that was the case. But, I mean, we've both been around long enough to know, and Mark, you as well. I mean, this long precedes 2020. I recall it was like 2010 when it was Democrats pounding on drums outside Maricopa County, tabulation center saying, you know, count the vote. And so this is not new, and it's not a mystery why it's taking so long to finish the vote count. It is the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of ballots that people request to vote by mail that they don't vote by mail, and they drop off on election day. That is the issue.
And to that point, that's a system that Arizona voters want, and it's incredibly popular, right? I mean, it's a popular system. It provides Arizonans the opportunity to select the candidate of their choosing, and they should have that decision, right? Whether to drop it off at the polls or mail it.
Well, it seems like voters will get a chance to weigh in on whether they want to keep it that way. So moving from the speed with which ballots are counted to the speed at which some legislators drive, see what I did there? There's a proposal that gained approval in a House committee this week to ask voters to do away with legislative immunity for traffic tickets, just for traffic tickets. We saw already this year two state legislators got out of tickets because they are state legislators. This seems like one, Reginald, that would maybe have a harder time getting out of the legislature than getting approved by voters.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't think voters think that there should be, you know, two forms of justice, one for lawmakers and then one for everyday citizens. You know, I think, you know, it is commendable that both Republicans and Democrats are saying, hey, this legislative immunity statute that's on the books is outdated. We don't need it. You know, if you are breaking the law as a lawmaker or as a citizen, you need to be held account. And I think it's going to pass and be signed to law by the governor.
What I mean, curious what you make of this. Governor Doug Ducey had asked lawmakers several years back to do away with this after a few lawmakers had gotten busted for speeding and not had to pay their tickets. Do you think this is something that legislators will get behind in large numbers?
That's going to be fascinating.
Isn't it?
I mean, I think it's an open question. If it does get to the ballot, it's going to break all records for public support. I mean, you're going to be able to count the no votes on your hand. So, I think everybody's going to be watching very closely.
And, like, I guess, I mean, both of you have spent a lot of time. You were in the legislature, Reginald. Matt, you spent a lot of time around legislators. Is there, like, what's the justification for trying to use this when you're not going to miss a vote? You can call the Senate president or the House speaker and say, hey, I'm running a little late. Can you hold up for a minute if it's going to be a close vote? Like, what's the justification for using this anymore?
I mean, let's just call it what it is. It is using privilege in a position that, you know, you in situations when you shouldn't be using it. At the end of the day, you know, they're not even on. My understanding is that these lawmakers weren't even in, you know, they weren't trying to go make a vote. I mean, some of these, you know, things are happening after hours or on weekends. I mean, it's just simply trying to use the privilege of the position. Because of that, you know, I think, you know, that should be definitely taken off the books.
Matt, as a kind of inside baseball question, this proposal was sponsored by Representative Wynn from Prescott Valley. And the first person this session who used legislative immunity is his seatmate, Mark Fincham. Does this cause inter-district or inter-legislative district squabbles, do you think?
Oh, 100%. But I think that friction preceded the bill.
Ah.
There are no coincidences.
All right. So another committee this week that got to work that hadn't been at work for quite a while was the so-called Dino Committee. This is the panel that vets Governor Hobbs' nominees to lead agency directors. It had met for like a year and a half. There's a whole lawsuit. The governor withdrew her nominees and then tried to appoint them basically as assistant executive directors or whatever the name was. The legislature sued. The legislature won. So the governor and this committee are going back at it. Matt, this week, Michael Weishart, the new head of DES, was unanimously confirmed by the Dino Committee. But it's interesting that we are in February now, about a month into session, and this is the only hearing they've had and the only nominee that they've heard.
Yeah, not exactly moving at the speed of business.
Is this another one of those there are no coincidences?
No, there are not.
What do you make of this? This is Michael Weishart, somebody who's worked at DES for quite a while. Governor Ducey had tapped him to lead the agency during his administration. Well, clearly somebody who seems to know what he's doing there.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a softball for the governor's administration, and this is also a softball for the Dino Committee. You know, it gives them the ability to say, hey, you're sending us names, and we're approving folks. And it's the governor's office saying, hey, we're trying to meet you in the middle. You know, we're trying to find folks who would be amenable to the committee. Ultimately, I don't think that we're going to see many more of these confirmations, which is unfortunate. You know, the governor should have the ability to select, you know, her directors of choosing to run her administration. But, you know, ultimately it was a win for both the administration and the Dino Committee.
Well, and Reginald, to your point, the Senate GOP had called on the director of the Housing Department, that nominee, Joan Service, to resign over some allegations there. So we'll see exactly how much how many nominees this committee actually gets through. Reginald Boulding, Matthew Benson, I'm Mark Brody. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week, former state lawmaker Reginald Boulding and Matthew Benson of Veritas. Reginald, let me start with you on what the sponsor, a bill, is calling the Bounty Bill. This would put a fee on international wire transfers and take that money, put it into an account, and would give Arizona law enforcement agencies a certain amount of money if they arrest somebody in this country illegally, and that person eventually gets deported.
Yeah, this is probably one of the worst pieces of legislation that I've seen down at the legislature. This bill would essentially provide a financial motive for law enforcement to target people based on race, ethnicity, and perceived immigration status. That's just something that we don't do. And it absolutely has the ability to erode the trust between the community and law enforcement. I mean, moreover, what you're going to find is immigrant communities, communities of color, they're going to be afraid to call 911. They're going to be afraid to call the police and report crimes out of fear that the law enforcement may have a financial motive to, you know, arrest someone. And that's just not something that we want to do. I mean, there's a number of issues. I mean, even moreover, you know, families who are from immigrant backgrounds who are sending, you know, legal wire transfers over to folks in other countries, they're now gonna, you know, have to pay an additional fee. So they're gonna have a deeper burden when they decide to send money back home. this bill is just one on so many different fronts that's bad, and I believe the governor already indicated she would veto it.
Yeah, she was not unclear about what she would do with this bill if it got to her desk. Matt, the sponsor of this bill, Senator Jake Hoffman, says this will not lead to racial profiling. We heard that at the top of the show, that this doesn't tell law enforcement how to do their job. I would imagine he would go on to say, in theory, this is something they should be doing anyway, and we'll just reward them for doing it.
Yeah, I mean, look, the financial incentive here created is obviously a step the state has never taken before. I would tell you this, Mark. There is a meteor the size of a 10-story building hurtling through space toward Earth. I don't know how much time we have left, and we're talking about a bill that there is no earthly chance the governor will entertain. It's political theater. And that happens at the state capitol, but it's not going anywhere.
Wait, you're saying political theater happens at the state capitol? I don't believe that. Well, so along those same lines, there was a Senate committee this week that approved a bill. Presumably, this is also one that the governor would not sign, although I don't believe she's spoken up on it, that would essentially require state agencies and local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE and other federal immigrant authorities. Would you put this under that same category, Matt, in terms of political theater? Is this maybe more of a substantive discussion?
This is certainly more substantive. And I think this is obviously aimed at those communities that have, quote unquote, sanctuary policies that prevent their law enforcement from cooperating with the feds. I think we saw via the proposition that voters overwhelmingly approved at the ballot in the last election, Arizona voters want to see local authorities cooperating with the feds on immigration-related enforcement. And so this is just more of the same.
Do you agree, Reginald, this is maybe a more of a substantive discussion than the bounty bill?
More substantive, absolutely. Misguided, misdirected, I believe so. I mean, when you look at public safety, local public safety, there are a number of different issues that our local law enforcement community definitely need to have the resources to fight. And by diverting their attention and their resources to federal immigration law really moves from, you know, the local public safety issues that communities are asking for. I mean, every single year you look at every city, every town, there's a conversation about law enforcement needing additional resources. So now what we're saying is we're going to stretch their resources even further when there's already gaps there. I just don't think that it's misguided and misallocation of resources.
Matt, let me ask you kind of a philosophical question, because for so long we've heard, especially from Republican lawmakers, that, you know, if the federal government won't deal with this issue, we have to ask the state. But the federal government clearly is now taking this issue very seriously and taking a lot of action. It doesn't seem, at least from an outsider perspective, that the legislature is sort of backing off on immigration bills. So I'm curious, like, what's the calculus there? What's the thinking there for the GOP?
Yeah, the calculation's pretty simple. I mean, illegal immigration and border security remain arguably the number one, maybe the number two issue among voters statewide. And the belief that, yes, the federal government is taking this issue seriously for a change, but that there's a benefit to leveraging all resources and having them work together, and certainly not having communities that, you know, have sanctuary policies that prevent them from coordinating with the feds on this issue. It's a big enough issue that it requires all hands on deck.
So not so much a matter of, okay, the feds are finally dealing with this, let's let them deal with it and see what they do and how well it goes, and then we can sort of fill in the gaps. They're trying to get in on it sort of on the front end?
Absolutely, and I think that's what we have seen, that is what voters want in this state, whether you're talking about approval of the proposition in the last election, Donald Trump's election, you know, in 2024, I mean, you name it, this is what voters want.
Well, so let me ask you, Reginald, the flip side of that, which is that, as Matt said, like, this does seem to be something that voters have voted for. They put Donald Trump back in office. He ran on a platform of mass deportations, among other immigration and border related issues. So Democrats sort of in the opposition at the legislature, what's the thinking there in terms of maybe how far to take some of that opposition, or maybe here's some things that maybe we don't oppose that we would have in the past?
Well, I think it's I would push back on just sort of the narrative regarding what Donald Trump ran on. You know, he wasn't specific at all during that campaign. And there is conversations about border security, right? You know, now with regards to border security and, you know, deporting, and folks and separating, you know, moms from their children, people who've been here undocumented, who have, you know, committed no crimes, you know, ripping, you know, going into schools and child care centers and churches. I don't know if folks voted for that. You know, they voted for, you know, border security. And I think that there are significant differences when you talk about immigration, whether we're talking about deportations, refugee asylums, border security, we're, you know, building a wall. It's not just one thing. And I think that what we've seen is the GOP has actually been very successful of pulling a bait and switch and saying, hey, you said you voted for us because of immigration. So that means all things immigration that we have the ability to do. And I don't think that's what voters are saying.
So then in your mind, should Democrats sort of be focusing on the how as opposed to the what?
I absolutely believe so. I mean, you know, I think you have to be pragmatic when you talk about providing an immigration solution. It is not a simple one-size-fits-all model. So what's the policy? What does the policy do? And then we need to have the discussion by policy, not just on the, you know, 30,000-foot level immigration conversation.
Okay, guys, just a couple minutes left. Let me ask you about one other bill that is working its way through the legislature, this dealing with the death penalty and would switch out lethal injection, which is the state's current method of executing a death row inmate, and instead go to the firing squad. Political theater, substantive discussion. Matt, what do you think?
I mean, it's not going to happen. Now, what I would tell you is the reason this bill comes forward is because the anti-death penalty extremists in that legal movement have made it virtually impossible to obtain the drugs required to conduct an execution in Arizona and other states. And so that's part of the reason it takes years and years to finally get justice for these victims' families and whatnot. And so here we are, you know, talking about a firing squad.
Arizona, though, has had its issues over the past several years in terms of successful. I mean, if you can call it successful, successfully carrying out executions under the current method.
Yeah, I think what I would tell you is states know how to conduct a humane and efficient execution. The difficulty is obtaining the proper substances to do it, and that's because of the. You know, there's an entire movement of folks out there who put every bit of their energy into making sure states can't obtain those substances.
Reginald, do you think this is something that's actually going to happen?
I don't think it's something that's going to happen. I mean, I think, you know, whether or not, you know, you have a death penalty in this state is a substantive conversation, and people have different views on it, whether they're religious views or, you know, or not. And, you know, I think this is a broader conversation, but you know, ultimately, you know, if a state's going to have, you know, a death penalty, it should be done in a humane way, something that, you know, voters agree with. So,
all right, we'll have to leave it there. Reginald Boulding, Matthew Benson, thanks you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the final installment of our Overwhelm series, looking into potential solutions to accommodate patients with autism and serious mental illness at the Arizona State Hospital. But first, let's turn to a story about one of the first local cases of a family being separated amid the Trump administration's mass deportations. Last week, an undocumented immigrant from Venezuela was selling empanadas at a gas station in Tucson with two of her kids in tow when she says a woman verbally attacked her and called the police. DPS troopers showed up. She packed up her children and her things and started to leave, but the troopers followed her and pulled her over down the road for driving under the speed limit. Arizona Luminaria reporter John Washington reported the story. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him about what happened next and what it says about what family separations might look like under President Trump.
They took her out of the vehicle. She called a church elder that is a community member that she had gotten to be close with, who came to the scene. As they were in discussions, the Border Patrol showed up. So the troopers had called Border Patrol, and the Border Patrol agents proceeded to put her in handcuffs in front of her children and began to question her. They then took her and her two kids, ages 6 and 9, into custody. They took them to Border Patrol's short-term holding facility just off the Air Force base. And this mom describes that moment, the beginning of that time in detention, as a night of interrogation. She says that she was aggressively questioned, accused of being a gang member. She says that agents accused her 6-year-old daughter of her father being a gang member, all of which the family vehemently denies. An important point here is that she has two other children, and they were at home at that point with her sister-in-law. And she said that she told the state troopers, the Border Patrol agents, repeatedly throughout the night that she wanted to contact her kids or her family to let them know where she was and why she hadn't come home.
Yeah.
And they never once afforded her a single phone call.
Right. So she is taken into custody with two of her children, but two other children, right, are still in Tucson. And for days, they did not know where she was. This was a bit of a scramble. People were frantic.
People were frantic. They presumed that she was taken into custody with the kids, but they did not know. And they didn't hear from her at all for over 3 days. And when they finally did hear from her, she had been already deported to Mexico. Remember, she's from Venezuela.
Right.
And she had been bused 2,000 miles south to the southern end of Mexico. And that was when she was able to borrow a phone, a working phone, and call her family, who were both at that point relieved to be back in touch, but also in a state of shock after 3 days of knowing nothing and then hearing that the family is separated and two of the kids are 2,000 miles away.
Right. So deported, they're in southern Mexico now. I know you've been in contact with them, but let me ask you a little bit about what happened and how this all played out. Because what you said was that, you know, the troopers pulled her over, Border Patrol was contacted, and they were there very quickly afterward. Is that typical procedure for law enforcement in Arizona?
It is a legal procedure. I don't know if I could say it's exactly typical. I think there's been a ramp up of this kind of rapid enforcement. You know, DPS has in the past had agreements with Department of Homeland Security to act basically as immigration agents. The other most commonly present law enforcement agencies in Tucson, TPD, and then the Sheriff's Department, say that they don't act as immigration agents nearly as much as DPS, but we have seen this in the past. What is more unusual with this case is how swiftly she was deported.
Right.
So she and her children were picked up in the evening on a Tuesday night, and they were out of the country very early Wednesday morning. So it was maybe 10 hours. We don't know exactly, but it was really quick.
Let me ask you about that in particular, because there are certain rights that you are supposed to have under the U.S. legal system, even if you are in the country without papers. What are they, and how would this deportation have played out should there have been due process, a court hearing, et cetera?
Yeah, well, there is a very critical piece of context here that she had already been given a final order of deportation. So that means that she could be deported pretty much at any time. However, the family explains, and her attorney, who I've been in touch with, also explained that she actually, when she first came to the United States, she settled for a time in Chicago with her family. She moved to Texas and then to Arizona, and she petitioned to change the venue so that she could attend court locally in Tucson. And on the day that she was supposed to show up in court, she went to the court, but they hadn't successfully changed her venue. So her hearing was being held in Chicago. She showed up to court in Tucson, trying to follow all the regulations, and yet she was ordered deported in absentia. And she was fleeing, as she made very clear, because she and her family were being persecuted in Venezuela. She feared for her death in Venezuela. She also, the first time when she was traveling north to the United States with her kids, she was actually kidnapped in Mexico. So she told agents, Border Patrol agents, while she was in custody this most recent time, that she was scared for her life, not only to be returned to Venezuela, but also she was scared to be returned to Mexico. We know Mexico is not a safe place for migrants right now.
So this story fits so many of the major kind of headlines that we're seeing about mass deportations under the Trump administration and about asylum seekers under the Biden administration when we saw such a surge of people like her coming here and seeking asylum. She obviously did not receive that asylum, as most people who were coming here seeking asylum did not receive that status. What kind of broader context does this fit into, John? Like, should we be expecting the Trump administration to carry out deportations regardless of family status, mixed family status, family separation? What has the Trump administration said about family separation?
So the first round of family separation starting in 2018, that was a really intentional policy to go after and to deliberately separate families as a deterrent strategy. This is not exactly what we're seeing right now. I think we're going to see more family separation as a consequence of other policies. And those policies include basically everyone who does not have papers or everyone who is being stripped of papers, as we're seeing with the taking away of TPS or temporary protected status to including Venezuelans. All those people are targets now for ICE, for Border Patrol. So people are going to be separated from their families when they are picked up indiscriminately, basically. We have reports of people being detained when they're going to their check-ins with ICE. Mm. So these are people who have some sort of provisional status or are working to get status. They go to their check-ins as is mandated by ICE. And instead of saying, yes, I'm here, I'm still working on my case, they just get arrested and put into the deportation process.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. That is John Washington, reporter for Arizona Luminaria, joining us from Tucson. John, thanks for your reporting here. Thanks for coming on.
Yep, thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. In the final installment this week of our series Overwhelmed, KJZZ's Athena Ankra and Amy Silverman explore potential solutions to the challenges faced by patients at the Arizona State Hospital, including those with autism. Athena Ankra begins this report at Maricopa County Psychiatric Hospital.
In this series, we've heard from patients at the state hospital with autism who say they're not getting the appropriate accommodations.
So no matter where I go in here, I can't escape the sensory overstimulation that all this noise and motion and commotion causes. I've constantly advocated for myself to get tools that could somewhat mitigate the harmful environment.
My autism's been a common struggle here. They tried a couple things, but eventually gave up the effort, you know.
Well, I have asked in the past, and I gave up asking after the first time because they kind of dodged around the question, kind of beat around the bush. And I used to have a sensory box full of, like, different things that I could use, and I got stressed out, like fidget spinners and such, and they took those away from me.
We also heard from Summer Walter, who says her brother, Darren Beach, was at an all-time low after his time at Ash.
He got worse. By the time he left Ash, over the course of that time, he ended up leaving Ash on over 9 different psychiatric meds.
Today, Darren Beach is doing better, his sister says. He's out of jail and living at Valleywise, Maricopa County Psychiatric Hospital, as he waits for a suitable community housing placement. Valleywise has been a game changer, Walter says. And that is because of Dr. Carol Olson. Olson is the medical director for the hospital's psychiatric division. She sees patients who have been ordered by the courts to receive treatment and are waiting for available beds at the state hospital or elsewhere. Sometimes a patient waits for months or even years. Because Valleywise is a hospital setting and not equipped for long-term living like Ash, Olson says that can be a negative. Imagine being stuck in a hospital room for months on end.
Unlike Ash officials and medical personnel, Olson agreed right away to an interview as long as it wasn't about specific patients. A tour was a different matter. Although promised, it was rushed. Microphones had to be turned off as reporters were escorted through heavy metal doors and past a few empty rooms in the adolescent unit. There's a whiteboard on one wall with a daily schedule. Every minute is accounted for. A call box-style phone hangs on a wall in front of the nurse's station encased in plexiglass. Each living quarter holds a small cot, and one empty room at the end of the hall is reserved for timeouts.
The tour ends in Olson's office, where she competes with piles of paperwork and books to find a spot to sit and talk. She, too, does not have formal data. But Olson is seeing a significant percentage of patients with autism and serious mental illness. She and her staff do their best, she says, to provide accommodations. The financial cost can be high.
In almost all cases where the person has significant autism, we have a one-to-one staff member with them at all times. That's one of the reasons why a lot of hospitals don't want to take people with autism or other types of developmental disorders because it requires extra staff.
There are easier, more affordable ways to help patients with autism, Olson says.
And then obviously we can try to do things like weighted blankets or doing other types of kind of more sensory modalities for people.
Apparently, that is not so obvious to others. Two other patients in Matt Solon's unit at the state hospital spoke with KJZZ and asked that their names not be used because they fear for their safety.
I've been here at the hospital 7 years and haven't got treatment for my autism, PTSD, anything, any of that. When I was a kid as well, when I got too anxious, my mom would say, go take a warm bath, and it would calm me down immediately. That was a huge coping skill for me, and they took that away.
Another patient says his autism has become a common struggle at ASH.
You know, I used to calm myself down by taking a bath, but now they've shut off the bathtubs. There's so much wrong with this place. If prison is hell, this is purgatory, I would say.
Matt Solon echoes the sentiments.
I end up in the situation I'm at now, with still no treatment and no faith that when I get out, the exact same thing isn't going to happen the first week I'm out there.
Holly Giesel, Solon's attorney, says treatment plans are a joke, and no one at the hospital will take accountability for what is or is not happening.
Everybody stands in a circle and points left.
Patients are isolated for having an emotional outburst, Giesel says, and that means therapy is withheld. To her, that makes no sense.
You don't go to treatment. When you're restricted to the unit, you don't get to go to your groups. If you throw your orange juice against the wall because you have intermittent explosive disorder, you just lost a month of treatment. Please, please ask why. Why is the Arizona State Hospital permitted to discipline people who are the most severely mentally ill there because they are insane, and they discipline them by taking away treatment?
The path to reforming the system isn't clear, because pretty much everyone involved agrees that the law already requires ASH to provide accommodations for patients with autism. Asim Dietrich is an attorney with Disability Rights Arizona, a nonprofit agency funded by the federal government that represents people with disabilities.
ASH is bound by both the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Arizonans with Disabilities Act to make sure that they provide the needed reasonable modifications for individuals with disabilities. So yeah, if it's indefinitely, if it's something that's needed for a disability, there needs to be an individualized assessment to determine how to accommodate that disability.
Other Arizona laws specifically mandate that appropriate treatment be provided for patients at the state hospital. But that doesn't mean those laws are being enforced. State lawmaker Catherine Miranda is concerned.
To have autism and the psychotic disorder, like schizophrenia, together, I mean, they have to meet these patients where they're at, and that's not happening.
In a statement, ASH officials say that when warranted, accommodations are given to patients with autism. But without more detail on either end, it's hard to know what's really going on inside the hospital. It could simply be that there's not enough funding available. According to a clinical improvement plan current ASH CEO Michael Sheldon released in 2023, the hospital doesn't have enough state funding to hire staff who are specifically trained to work with patients with autism. The same report concluded that ASH had more than 80 full-time staff vacancies and needs a total of 117 positions filled to meet its current obligations. This is not a new challenge. In 2021, Sheldon's predecessor, Aaron Bowen, told lawmakers that ASH couldn't accommodate patients with autism.
We do not have the ability to treat autistic spectrum disorders or developmental disabilities without the appropriately trained niche staff who specialize in this type of treatment. it's very challenging for Ash to accept these types of patients into the state hospital and effectively treat them.
But additional funding won't change the fact that there's little transparency or accountability when it comes to the Arizona State Hospital. One reason so many serious matters remain unresolved, advocates say, is because independent oversight committees have no power. IOCs, as they are known, are mandated by state law and operated by the Department of Administration as a way of monitoring the state hospital as well as the state's Division of Developmental Disabilities. Citizen members of the Ash IOC review redacted internal reports, ask questions, and listen to patient concerns. But beyond reporting their findings, IOC members can do nothing. Autism advocate Cynthia McCluskey has many years of experience sitting on an IOC.
We have the power to ask questions, and we ask, and we ask, and we push, and we push. But we don't have the power to make them do anything. They can hear it. They can give advice. It doesn't mean the system has to follow it. We don't have any real power.
The most recent annual report for the Ash IOC, dated October 2024, details a range of concerns, including a lack of immediate medical attention at night and on weekends, that the Phoenix Fire Department was not responding to calls as there was confusion over whether the Ash Forensic Unit is a prison or a hospital, and allegations by patients of retribution when they complained to the IOC and elsewhere.
The report also noted that, quote, loud day rooms and bright lights have caused discomfort, especially for patients with autism spectrum disorder. IOC members also reported concerns that staff were acting inappropriately. Quote, we substantiated claims that two employees were very aggressive and acted in a manner that escalated situations. The report reads, four committee members reviewed the videotapes of the incident. The employee was put on administrative leave while investigating the incident, but later returned to work on the unit. The employee involved in the incident was part of the treatment staff, sitting directly next to the patient in a staffing. The two staff had been reported to the IOC previously as intimidating to the patient.
The IOC's annual report also notes concern from patients over the fact that the state agency that operates the Arizona State Hospital is also charged with monitoring the hospital's performance and holding it accountable. It's not just patients who are unhappy with that. Advocates came close to getting that law changed in 2024, but ultimately failed. Here's Asim Dietrich again.
DHS imposes financial penalties against Arizona State Hospital for basically imposing financial penalties against their own department. So that's unlikely to occur. And then the other thing is to either terminate or suspend a license. And again, that's unlikely to occur because Ash is the only facility for most of the patients who reside there. And basically, Ash is the last resort.
Will Humble has also championed the effort to keep the state hospital from, in effect, monitoring itself. He headed the Arizona Department of Health Services from 2009 to 2015 and is now executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association.
A lot of the decisions that state agencies make are based on self-preservation and administrative ease rather than what's best for the state.
The State Department of Health Services is responsible for overseeing all kinds of medical facilities in the state, including hospitals. The department posts results from the last 3 years of inspections, including penalties. Over this time period, state inspectors noted that Ash failed to secure bathrooms, leading to the possibility that a patient could use a faucet as a tie-off point in a suicide attempt. It was also noted that the hospital failed to ensure a patient's bedroom was safe by having areas in which a patient could cut themselves. Inspectors also noted that staffing numbers were continually under the required levels and that staff were not properly trained in policies regarding seclusion and restraint of patients.
Another citation noted that 5 out of 5 seclusion or restraint rooms, quote, contained mirrors made of plexiglass that had sharp edges mounted on the interior wall of the rooms. The top of the mirrors, which were within reach of patients in all 5 rooms, had sharp edges that were not beveled. When touching the edges of the mirror in the first restraint seclusion room observed, one surveyor was cut on the hand by the mirror. It was also observed that the fire alarm pole station was obscured and that monthly sprinkler systems inspections had not taken place. Frayed power cords were being used. Over this 3-year time period, Ash received 2 enforcement actions, one for the forensic unit, the other for civil. Each was fined $500. On a practical level, Humble says he understands why accommodations like those Matt Solon is requesting aren't always made available.
What can happen is administrators, medical directors, and staff start to become more and more restrictive over time. Because if you give someone a privilege, noise-canceling headphones, as an example, and something bad happens with that, then you're going to be say, why in the world was this person given head-canceling headphones and they took out the battery and ate the battery? And you'll get in trouble for having given them the headphones.
That is not the right direction, Humble says. He holds Governor Hobbs responsible for Ash's shortcomings.
It's really key for the governor, the executive, to hold those agencies accountable to say, wait a minute, you're not here to make your job easy. You're here to meet the needs of the patients in Arizona.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankra.
And I'm Amy Silverman.
You can read a statement from the Arizona Department of Health Services at kjzz.org. You can also find an illustrated depiction of the Overwhelm series on our website. KJZZ is part of the Mental Health Parity Collaborative. The partners on this project include the Carter Center and newsrooms in select states across the country. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.